Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies.
And today we are talking to folks from Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities as we continue our Emmy series here. Man, again, the amount of effort that goes into a show like this, and speaking to different folks, such a thrill. First of all, so passionate. So passionate.
Well, you'd have to be to work for Guillermo.
You do. Oh, I can't. Yeah, I can't imagine. And he's a smart man. He keeps his team tight.
Yeah.
And he surrounds himself with the best of the best, which you'll hear us say repeatedly in this episode because they're all just so friggin' talented. And again, you don't have to have seen the series to listen to these people talk and explain their craft, explain where their mind is as they go into each job, how they create. It's just really wonderful listening to their stories.
It is. It's exciting.
Is that exciting? It's exciting. We're going to start today with Sean Sansom and Mike Hill, who are the super, super, super talented folks who did the prosthetic makeup. Sean is special makeup effects department head, and Mike is the prosthetics designer. And yeah, that's their nomination. And boy, did they do some beautiful work. Enjoy.
Our guests today are both Emmy nominees for special makeup effects on Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Prosthetics.
But they have been in that cabinet before, the small C.
Proud of yourself for that one?
Yeah.
Proud of yourself?
It's early in the morning. That's all I got. Welcome to Mike Hill and
you can do it. I believe in you.
Welcome to Sean Sansom and Mike Hill. Thank you, guys.
Nice to see you both.
What does recognition like this mean to you?
It's extremely flattering for one, I got to say. And use the right word, you know, this recognition. It is nice to be recognized when you put your heart and soul into a project for almost a year, you know, and you've been covered in fiberglass and paint and rubber and hair and dental acrylic and you name it, you know, for a whole year. So it is nice to be at the end of it for someone to basically say good job. So that's always doesn't suck, you know.
It doesn't. Mike, where are you from?
Yeah, I'm from the northwest of England.
Where?
A place called Warrington, right between Liverpool and Manchester.
My husband is from Manchester.
Oh, is he? I like him already.
Right?
I like Daisy, your husband. You've got to get your way in there now, you know?
I know. Give me time, okay? Give me time. No, I've been to Warrington, and I like it very much. So there.
Well, I do like you again then. There we go. Yeah, it came full circle.
It's true. It's. Are you there? And where are you now?
Oh, no, I live in LA now.
My husband, by the way, will not move back to the UK. He's fallen in love with Los Angeles and sunshine.
Me too.
That's what happens. You guys, you don't get enough sunshine. You come to LA and you say, all right, I'm staying here now.
And we meet beautiful ladies as well.
That'll do it, right?
Yeah.
Sean, where do you hail from?
Toronto.
A Canadian in the film business?
Imagine that.
Imagine that. And are you in LA as well?
Sorry?
Are you in LA as well or are you in Canada?
No, I'm in Toronto right now.
Beautiful. Okay. Lucky man.
Yeah.
You've both worked with Guillermo del Toro before on some pretty ambitious projects. Did you have any idea what he had in store with a series to fill?
Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I'd kind of been down this road with a series before, but not this ambitious because being on The Strain, I mean, it's all one storyline. So it's just a change in the story that we're dealing with. It's not necessarily a completely different story where, which like we said before, this is like working on 8 different episodes.
Yeah.
Or sorry, 8 different movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they very much were like shooting a feature film. Yeah. So it's not like TV at all.
No, and nothing he does is half-assed. Nothing he does is going to be simple or easy. And that's why he works with the best. He's a smart man, and he cares deeply. It's true, though, you know?
You're right. He does care deeply.
You know, it matters to him. We interviewed him, I guess, last year now, but we've known him for 20-ish years. We met mm-hmm. him when he was first going out with Devil's Backbone and spent time with him then and immediately fell in love because you can't not fall in love with him. He's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see him succeed the way he has succeeded, but stay this nerd, this fantastic nerd who just loves what he does and surrounds himself with people who are the same way.
Mm-hmm.
He's smart, you know? Yeah.
No, he is. He's smart and he's clever and he's considerate and he's a fine artist himself. I always say
yes.
With Guillermo, and I'm certainly repeating myself, but I always will. Guillermo del Toro himself is one of the greatest creature designers of all time.
Mm.
You know, and I'm glad on this particular show that little credit is in this. You know, creature concept.
Yeah.
You know, and it's deserved. You know.
When you see his drawings, you see his books. I mean, it's all there. It's he's incredibly creative.
He's always on. He's always switched on. You know, you can't.
Yeah,
he's got the finest eye. You know, he'll make changes that although originally, I've got to change it up a bit, but he's right. It makes sense. You know, he's extremely good at what he does, and he makes us all better artists and to, consider any changes or improvements we can make in our artwork. Guillermo will bring that out in you.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how buried that werewolf is deep inside you, he'll bring the wolf to the fore, you know, and you know, we admire that in him immensely.
What got you both into this?
Movie monsters. For me, it was when I was 4 years old that I saw King Kong, then a Hammer film, Curse of the Werewolf, and then that was it. I was locked in then, you know. Go, Sean.
You, Sean?
Yeah, for me, it was, I think it was Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. I saw it on TV, and that I just had no idea, like, where they found the Cyclops. How they were able to film with it and everything. Because, I was just like Mike, probably around Mike's age, like 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Which makes perfect sense, because Sean looks like he belongs in a swashbuckling Arabian.
You do.
Right?
You like you absolutely do.
Yeah. For sure. He's Cyclops.
Yeah, there you go. It's the same. You know, my dad doesn't do well with gory or scary. He fell in love with the original Universal Monsters.
Right, good.
You know, that's what he fell in love with.
I might as well just move in with you guys.
Well, I know. We're here. Give us a call anytime.
Let's look at my mat, you know?
Right. Oh, please. I've got a giant Frankenstein over that. I'll bring him over when we're done.
Okay.
This is, you know, you fall in love with it because it's brilliant. And and to see how they brought things to life before there were effects. And that's why what you guys do, I have great respect for people who are able to do the kind of effects that they do through computer, but there's just nothing, in my opinion, better than the stuff that's real, because it's so much scarier. It's so much more intense. It comes across in a different kind of way.
It's tangible as well.
Yeah.
It's tangible. You feel like you can grab a hold of it.
Or
even worse, it can grab a hold of you, you know?
Yeah. Well, it blows my mind. And that's the thing, you know, you spend time with somebody like Rick Baker, who obviously is the genius.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he lived down the street from us growing up.
Right.
And the first time my dad saw him,
I opened the door. I was working Halloween.
Giving out candy.
I opened the door, and there's Conrad Veidt as the man who laughs.
Oh, brilliant.
but and it was brilliant.
Yeah. Which, by the way, that movie gives me nightmares to this day. Yeah. And then seeing it in person was like, no, 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 no. It's not supposed to come to life. It's not supposed to be real. But it's the same thing. This is what he grew up with. This is what he loves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what he does for fun.
It's meeting these characters when you're a child. Yeah. You know, you let them in. You know, it goes beyond nostalgia.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
They're old friends, and you know, when you're looking for your monster mags as a kid, all your superhero mags, any of these fantastical beings that we have imagined, you know, humankind, which is all pure fantasy. But as a child, it isn't pure fantasy. They are your friends. They are the people you look up to, and the people you want to meet, scary or not. You can be scared of Frankenstein's creature as a kid, but you still admire it, and you still want to read about it, and you want to be scared by it because you understand that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's I just see him as kinship, all these creatures. You know?
Yeah.
has 3D printing entered your world? You guys who create prosthetics by hand and molds and things?
Well, it has entered our world, but it's not a hindrance to us. You know, we use it ourselves. I mean, personally, I don't use it for makeups, but I'll use it for other things that it can help to speed the process along and make things cleaner. And, you know, for the little thing, you don't have to make a whole mold and stuff like that. It's embracing, you got to embrace the technology because it ain't going anywhere.
No.
So, mm-hmm. so use it to your advantage. You know, this is not a click thing where, oh, computer do this and we do that and there, let's all butt heads. It's like, no, you know, we got to make this work and it's got to be uniform. You know, it's all got to weld together. So of course we've got to be up to date with the techniques. Otherwise we'll get left in the past. And actually, Rick Baker was a big advocate for that. He always moved with the times. You know, he didn't let him go. Because people like Jack Pierce back in the 40s, Jack Pierce, when he got laid off by Universal, because he wasn't moving with the times. He wasn't
right. He was a genius, but he refused to adapt.
Yeah.
That's right. And you have to adapt, and it's, yeah, it can be painful, but you know, there's not much time on the set. You've got to be quick. You've got to be fast. It's expensive. It's time consuming. The actor doesn't want to sit for 6 hours. So you have to do anything you can to speed up their process.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely.
It's just, how often have you two worked together?
We've worked together.
It's like five times.
Yeah.
In that world, yeah. We first met on Shape. Sean and I met previous to that because in another lifetime, we both used to sculpt model kit figures, you know, of these creatures, basically.
Of course.
So we knew each other via that. You know, we'd read each other's name in the same articles 20 years before we met each other.
Wow.
And then we met, really confirmed, was on obviously The Shape of Water, where we worked together for months.
Yeah. And you got someone like Doug Jones, who is just magical.
Yes, he is.
And he blows me away. I think he might be one of the warmest human beings on the planet.
Yeah,
he's wonderful. But it's wild to see how he, and talk about bringing things to life, watching him do that, artistry of that. He has
an unnatural grace, you know, that's hard to find in anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, that graceful movement where everything feels very delicate and very Byron Shelley-esque all the time, no matter what it's wearing, you know?
Yeah. It's nuts. God, all the pieces, right? Everything has to come together. Absolutely. Every single thing has to come together. Again, I mean, what you guys do, it's such an art form, mm-hmm. but then it has to be shot the right way. It has to be lit the right way.
Absolutely. You're
correct. It has to be filmed the right way. All of it. It's just, that's what excites, as you say, that's why it's so important to be, not necessarily given awards, but to get a little bit of time where people say to you, no, we see what you've done.
Exactly.
And it's brilliant. And it's not easy. And it's something that takes years. I mean, that's why I say you're both young and you've been doing it a long time. It's because it takes.
What a compliment.
It's true.
Why do you think I keep my lights down? You
know? Oh, please. Hey, on this podcast, the general age range is somewhere between 80 and 100. For our guests, so you are young. You are real young, Is 102 our oldest guest? I think it's something like that. Yeah. I think we hit
102. Is this called the sweetest podcast in the world?
No, it's, as I say, we're in awe of your talent. That's really it. No, but it's true. And it's amazing to watch what you guys were able to do for something like this again. And it's not a movie. That's the craziest bit
All the more so. Yeah. You do it on a TV budget and TV timetable.
Yeah.
And I know it's not
timetable. Timetable. Yeah. That is the bit. Having to put this many together. So yeah. How many do you know? I mean, you must know, but how many creatures did you create?
How many did you do in this show, Sean?
Well, you did.
I did.
Four.
Well, how many was he in total for the whole series? Was he a creature in every one? There was, right?
Must have been.
Yeah, there was the
did one.
Lots,
yeah.
Yeah. I think I did five, right? I think I did five actual physical, clay sculpture builds,
Do you have a favorite part? Is there a favorite part of the process for you? Or is it all of it and just seeing it come together?
Well, I think I can speak for Sean. We really like sculpting. We're sculptors, so I can't speak for Sean. Mine is sculpting. I like the character. Of course, it's fantastic to see first come to life breathing. But for me, I'm feeling it most when it's just me in a room, not on like this, but one light and just trying to find the emotion in what that thing is. Because when you sculpt these things, it's not about the outside visage. Anyone can look like a witch. Anyone can put a wart on the face and a big nose. But she has to have a soul and a personality. You have to live her life and know why she's been this. Like the Dreams of the Witch House, the episode that we're nominated for, she doesn't know she's a villain. She thinks she's correct. She's like every bloody politician in the world. She thinks she's right. But she's not right, But she's not. There's no malice in her. She's just doing what she thinks she has to do. Yeah. So you have to reflect that. And that's why giving her the crown that we built was very essential to us. Even at one time the crown wasn't going to happen, and I really fought for it because I had to say, look, she's a queen. She's very regal and she just doesn't know she's in the wrong. That's all. She doesn't know she's and you got to get that across in the clay. It's tricky, but you give it your best shot,
Yeah, but that's what makes it so cool is that you are carving this into clay and coming up with a whole story. That's it. This is a whole story that you are making, and exactly what you're saying. You're talking about psychology. You're talking about the detail.
Like every collaborator on films and television that we talk to, we end up coming away saying, well, you're storytellers.
Yeah, in every possible way, right?
You may be described in a more specific manner, prosthetic makeup, but you're storytellers.
Yeah.
No, that's a good analogy, really, is you have to be. So it's nice to hear somebody say that. Yeah,
but say it's true. It's thinking about all those sorts of things. It's wild to think that you are sitting in a dark room with one light, looking at clay, and saying, "Okay, she's this, she's this, she's this, she's this."
Yeah, well, you have to give him a. Let's say, for instance, you're doing a Bigfoot. You might put two bullet holes in his shoulder. You don't focus on them, and you don't put your camera on them. But they're there, and to say, look, he's been approached before, and he's been hurt before, and what has happened? You're basically just giving a history. As soon as you give a character a scar, you give it a history.
Yeah.
You don't have to explain where that scar came from. The audience can fill in the blanks, and so as long as you give them 70%, they can do the rest themselves,
And Sean, when are you going to play a swashbuckler?
After he's finished, it's strange. Yeah.
Not unless it's a Disney or a decayed version of one where I'm under heavy prosthetic.
Pirates of the Caribbean 9, and you'll you'll come swinging across something.
That's right.
Is it the
with
same?
A, is with is a it, knife in my mouth?
That's right. Is it clay for you? Do you love? Is sculpting your favorite part?
Yeah, because like Mike said too, that's kind of like the actor, like the life cast is the canvas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what we're doing, we're applying the clay, but the way it ends up looking is once the clay has been molded, there's no turning back unless it's redone completely. That kind of the sculpture determines how that character is going to look.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you are, and of course you're going to accentuate it with paint and you know, if you have to add any other like with the witch character with the extra vines and everything else, where it's like fabricated pieces, but the base of it is there, it's locked in. So it's that's what kind of determines the overall character.
And how did you learn when you're doing those casts? How did you learn to deal with the actors? How did you learn over the years of doing this? Because that is a, it's a difficult process. They have to be very calm. You're covering them in a saran wrap basically and giving them poking holes in their nose or their mouth. How did you learn to do that? How did you learn to work with someone and not scare the crap out of them as you cover them completely?
Well, I know saran wrap and poking holes. I don't know about that, but I get your point.
No, but you know what I mean? I mean, doing these casts of people's faces,
we don't particularly enjoy doing life masks ourselves, you know, because it is, you know, a process that makes the actor very, very uncomfortable. But, you know, but unfortunately we need it, you know, we need that input. So a lot, so sometimes we'll work as well with the actor. If an actor's claustrophobic, we'll say, okay, well, we'll just do the front half and maybe the back half separate if we need it. Yada, yada, you know, and you could even break it down if it was a scar here, you know, just mold this part. So we do work with them, but no, it is a very strenuous, you know, situation for both sides, the person in the chair and the person applying it. Because, you know, if anything goes wrong, which it doesn't, so I shouldn't be saying these words. This is
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. It's strenuous on all sides. I don't particularly enjoy the life mask sessions, but I'd rather be under it than doing it.
Right.
Yeah, because you can't be blamed for nothing, right?
That's it. But that's what I mean. But learning how
except
to do
perhaps
that.
Sneezing.
Yeah, right. But learning how to do that and learning how to, as I say, to work with somebody else, because a lot of what you – half of what you do is by yourself, and then the other half is actually applying it to a human being. And
correct.
So you have to figure out what's comfortable, what's not comfortable. Again, this is, it's, Rick Baker talks about how he thinks it's really funny that people complain today because he says, you have no idea the stuff we used to have to put on folks. So if you think this is bad, I remember there were these huge contact lenses he would put in and he showed just, and they looked like a nightmare. They looked like something that, you know, you would torture a person with.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, so nowadays you guys comparatively it's so much less, but still it's such a process that you're working with another human being.
Yeah.
And then they have to be able to move a certain way. They still have to be able to emote.
That's right.
Collaboration, it just comes back to that, doesn't it? You have to figure out.
It's a team. Yeah, it's a complete team to make one character. You know, a lot of people to make one character come to life. Yeah.
Wild.
So that's why we're happy with Dreams in the Witch House, because they gave her the witch a lot of screen time, you know. And sometimes we can spend months on these things and it's literally a blink. Like the witch we did for Pinkman's model, you hardly saw her. And we really liked that makeup, you know. It was really good. And it was just a blink. So at least with Dreams in the Witch House, this is why we like the episode, is we got to see our work. It was featured not really as a monster either. It was one of the principal characters. So that's always nice. It's always nice to get a Freddy. You know what I'm saying?
Where
there's a lot.
It's true. Again, I mean, the amount of work that goes into each and every piece, and for you and for the actor, it's nice if it can actually get its screen time.
Exactly.
And not just be the seeing it for 5 seconds as it flashes, though, as we know, that is just as important. But in terms of everything, it's nice when you can just sit there and stare at it.
Well, I think a lot of it is because when we do these makeups, for instance, like I say, the Pinkman's Witch, where it's very fast glimpses of this character and shocking moments, great. But if you could pause on it and look, you'd see all the little bits of hairs we put in the chin and in the warts and all this stuff. And, you know, that you just cannot catch in that time, you know.
No,
remember the actress
awesome.
For that one, you know, she's her eye, one of her eyes is taped shut. She's got a big Solera lens. She's got full mouthful of fangs. She's got full silicone appliances, a tight corset, gloves. You know, there's a lot we built that you know you hardly see. But that's filmmaking.
Yeah,
that's also great. They wanted to show, and it's their project. We're only helping them.
Yeah.
You
know, so, Sean, I'll close with this. Since Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, lit your fire. One time I got to talk to Catherine Crosby, who then was Catherine Grant, when she made that film. I asked her about it, and she said she was under contract into Columbia Pictures in the 50s, and she thought she was being punished to be given that role in this, you know, cheesy little kiddie film. And it's the one thing she's remembered for, really, other than her long marriage to Bing Crosby and raising a family with him. But acting-wise, she's remembered as the princess in Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Yeah.
That's before I'm going to bring over Frankenstein before I let you go, because I want you to see him. It's one of my dad's coolest pieces.
But I can't remember the
name. Boris Karloff's got to come walking in now, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the guy who did it, though. That's terrible.
Oh, there we go. That's a sideshow figure.
It is. It's a sideshow figure that was touched up by its creator.
Yeah. It's a sideshow figure. Yeah, very cool.
Isn't he great?
Yeah, I think Andy Bergot sculpted that likeness, I think.
I just love him.
Yeah, he's really good. Yeah.
He's one of our favorites.
Well, it's good. You got great taste.
And I have the Aurora Dracula model kit on my desk.
Oh, we've got the whole house. It's little kids live here. Which, P.S., trying to explain to a small human which toys are grandpa's and which toys are hers.
Yeah. Daisy, unfortunately, they're all hers. Yeah.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that's pretty much where we're at. But yeah, it's thank you guys so much for your
time. Thank you both.
Congratulations. So excited for you.
All right, next up is Tamara Deverell, and she's the production designer. Her nomination was Outstanding Production Design for a Narrative Period or Fantasy Program. I'm speaking to her. She's in her car. Her husband is driving her to work, and that's where she had time to speak to me. So I hope you can hear her all right. She's giving it her all. She's fascinating. At one point, she stops to get coffee. Working lady. So please enjoy Tamara.
You and I were just starting to talk about Guillermo a little bit because you've worked with him a number of times, and he is a smart man. He knows that when he has someone good, he needs to hold on tightly because he has fantastical visions, and someone has to then actually take that and make it real life. Mm-hmm. And you are one of those people, those crazy, crazy people who listens to what he says and goes, yeah, I'll figure this out.
Yeah. It takes a lot of figuring sometimes. We just got off a meeting and I'm like, it was a bad reception because I'm in the car. I'm in
sure.
a better reception zone. But I was like, I'm not sure how that's going to work, but we'll figure it out exactly.
We'll figure it out. It's just one of those, it's a bit like we'll fix it in post, except you're not post.
And, you know, one thing about Guillermo is he does like to actually build things, which keeps me in business.
Yes.
Which I obviously like to do, or I wouldn't do what I do. So, you know, although he relies heavily on VFX, he really likes the sets to be fully realized. So even though it might turn into VFX, I do have a big hand in designing the parts that aren't. Like on Cabinet of Curiosities, we built half of the Murmuring House, the exterior half, the lower half. Obviously, we built all the interiors. And the same thing with the Dreams of the Witch House. So we conceptualized the whole house, but we just built a little bit. You know, design really matters to somebody like Guillermo.
He's someone who cares so deeply. And I think that because he has that way about him, he's a little boy. And what he wants to make is what he dreams up in his head. And there's nothing quite like stunts in real life, like real makeup, like creating those pieces and having them there. For an actor, it has to be a dream because it means you don't have to pretend. And then for everyone creative who has to build it, it means that you make something that absolutely blows people away.
Yeah.
And it's a gift. You have so many interesting credits, including Degrassi. I love that Degrassi's in there because I absolutely watched all of that.
It's so funny. You just heard Linda Schuyler, who's the creator of Degrassi, on the radio just now as I'm driving from one place to another. Yeah, Degrassi was a good one.
That it's, but I mean, you really, you've got such a wide array, and in some cases art director, in some cases production design. But I mean, to have something like Degrassi, but then to have something like 54, which again, visually, to create all of that, take people back in time to something that for some they know so well, for others they've only seen in pictures. You know, how do you begin?
You know, how do you begin? I mean, I begin by doing some research. You know, it's all, to me, it's all about, you know, I love doing period stuff, which is, I think, why I like to work with Guillermo, because he does a lot of period
stuff. Oh, yeah. So there's
a lot of research involved, a lot of background, a lot of, and not just like, you know, how did they build buildings in 1800 or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so looking at paintings and reading, you know, different historic books or pieces on different periods, because you can't source, you know, so much is dependent, so much of our modern world is photography, but it really didn't exist so much 100 or 200 years ago. So
well, they didn't have photography back. Did they have phones? Why didn't they just take pictures with their phones? That would have made much more sense.
Yes, right.
Yeah, they should have just done Instagram. Why wouldn't they? Exactly.
Even Instagram I've been using, because there's great, like, you start to follow these people who do like abandoned buildings, like, you know, historical buildings, which is great for design work, especially the kind of design work I do with Guillermo, where it's, you know, there's a lot of old ruins of things on the current project we're working on, especially. So,
are you in Canada right now?
I am. I'm in Nova Scotia, and I'm getting beautiful on a plane tomorrow to go to the UK. Yeah.
Wow. Nova Scotia is a gorgeous place. Is that where you're from? Where are you from?
No, I'm actually from the prairies originally, and I grew up on the West Coast, so I've been all over this country. And we have a place now, my husband and I, in Nova Scotia. We're building a house. So.
That's a talk about inspirational, though. If you want to be inspired, any of those sort of cities. Absolutely magical. But so, yeah, your art director for Mimic, which is many moons ago, how did that come to be?
I had been working with Carol Spear, who for a number of years, who does a lot of the David, pretty much almost all of David Cronenberg's films. And that's how Guillermo got to know her, through his work.
Sure.
And he was coming up to Toronto to shoot Mimic, and he was like, well, I want David Cronenberg's designer. And I'd been working with Carol on a couple of David Cronenberg movies, so that's how we fell into she fell in, and I followed dutifully.
Right. And then you've got X-Men, no big deal. And then you got Death to Smoochie. Yeah, I can't imagine me. Art director at X-Men has just got a... And the collaboration as well. There's so many moving pieces to something like that.
Yeah, that was a big learning curve for me, because exactly that, there was so, and when you're art director, you tend to deal with, you know, more of like the stunts and the special effects and all the interdepartmental stuff. Whereas when you're production designing, which I'm doing now, you're more involved with just the director or costume designer, you know, cinematographer, direct line. So it's just a bit of a different thing. I mean, I loved it. I loved art directing those big movies. They were super fun.
I love Death to Smoochie. Yeah. It's such a strange movie, but something.
Well, you know, speaking of Degrassi, I know this is going to sound weird, but they are connected. Death to Smoochie, we had all these sort of the network, the kid network offices that we built. I can't remember what it was, what the offices were, what the company or the fake company was called.
Sure.
But when, at the end of it, it just timed out that I started doing the design work for Degrassi, and I repurposed all of the glass walls in the high school set.
Oh, how
funny. The company, otherwise they'd go in the bin. And so the company would give, I think it's sorry, we're at a we're at a drive-through coffee place.
Order your coffee. So, don't worry about it.
Yeah, so I love you know, I love the fact that we were able to reuse instead of throwing out all this excellent scenery.
Yeah.
And make, you know, make the movie look better, make the show look better with big, you know, feature movie they were glass wall dividers. At any rate, that's a little Easter.
I know. I love that the two of them come together. And then you were production designer for Charlie Bartlett, another really wonderful small film that not enough people saw, with Anton Yelchin, who was so special.
Yeah, that's a sad one.
It's a heartbreaking one, but it's
big loss.
It's just so interesting to look through the different things that you've done. Breakout Kings, which is a show I really like. I love Jimmy Simpson. And, you know, you do something like that. You worked on Suits. The Strain, which again, visually, one hell of a undertaking.
Yeah, that was a big show. Well, I did all of The Strain. That was four seasons of endless,
It's a lot.
Yeah, it was a
understatement to say that's a lot.
And then that's when I really like made it in Guillermo's books, that I survived The Strain.
You could do that. That was his trial by fire. Mm-hmm. And then Star Trek Discovery. Again, just visually something that's so complicated.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great thing to do career-wise for me. I mean, I really learned a lot. Everything is built, and it's all, you know, trying to imagine the unimaginable, basically, and still stick with the Star Trek canon. So that was really interesting. And I did it for 2 years, which felt just about right.
Yes.
So I didn't become like retiring on Star Trek, which, you know, I could have. Like,
right.
Still be in the Star Trek family. And they were really, it was really nice. It was great doing that. And I got to design the Enterprise, you know, our version of the Enterprise, which I had grown up with.
Sure.
That was really special.
It's just, as I say, you're creating these worlds, and truly without what you're doing, it just doesn't exist. And it's sort of it's the starting point. And for your actors, because whenever you speak to actors, you know, what do they say to you? Oh, it's the hair, it's the makeup, it's the costuming, and then it's the set, you know, to put them into the place they need to be. And I just can't, the idea that you sort of start with nothing and then they go, okay, hi camera, here's what I need. Make me a world, please.
Yeah. Well, so what is, you know, it's, you say that, but it's great when you see the actors walk onto your set and it forms their character. Like on Nightmare Alley, Kate Blanchett, we did her Dr. Lilith's office, and she actually came up to me, and I'm sort of gobsmacked because I'm really, you know, I really admire her as an actor and as a person. And she came up and she said, "You are fantastic. You are amazing." And she was all in her makeup and her hairpin, and I was just like, I literally was like, blah blah blah. Oh, thank you, Miss Blanchett. No, she really that was really a big moment for me to have her say, so you made my character,
of course,
to move through. And so I mean, you know, I had imagined her, you know, the way she moves and moving through the space and designing for her ability to through. And then Guillermo kept pushing it to get bigger and bigger, and I was like, oh my god, this is so not a, the office we started with. It became the size of a train car. It was just something that Guillermo could choreograph both the actors in.
Right.
Really, it was just the two of them in there.
Well, that I mean, again, in terms of Nightmare Alley, the look of it is so, it has to be beautiful and dark. And again, obviously the costumes, everything else, in collaboration, that's what keeps coming up. You know, we're getting to speak to costume designers, the hair, the makeup, all these different folks doing the VFX, also doing the practical effects. It's just, I think, you know, you say gobsmacked to meet Kate Blanchett. For me, it's looking at all of these people and seeing what they bring to life. And that to me is just, it blows my mind. It blows my mind what you're able to make. What got you into doing this?
I was in art school and I just was kind of spreading myself thin. I wanted to just do everything, sculpture, painting, photography, filmmaking, graphic art. I was studying and I really just couldn't land on anything. And it was actually my father who was a lawyer, criminal lawyer, and he became a writer. And he sort of said, you maybe to try the film industry because I hear you can, it's people who have multiple talents can make their way in that world, knowing nothing about it, my father. And so he kind of encouraged me and helped me get my first job with, he was writing a screenplay. So there's a bit of nepotism there. But he was right. It was sort of like I was a bit of a lost soul. And then I found my niche, and I didn't even know from what the art department was. I started in costumes, a very small Canadian movie.
Sure.
And then I sort of noticed that there were people doing sets. And I was like, well, what's that? And then other people noticed that I could draw, that I was artistic. And like the continuity woman sort of said, you've got to meet this designer, which was Francois Seguin, who's a well-known Quebecois designer. And then I worked with him for a few years and I was really lucked into that. Then I moved, I met my husband and he was in Toronto. So I moved to Toronto like so many people do.
Right.
And then I worked in Toronto for a while. Carol Spear, who I had the good fortune of working with. And really between, Francois and Carol and also working with John Meyer on X-Men, I really I learned my craft.
Yeah.
But I also at this time, I hadn't studied like a lot of people who do what I do come from an architectural background or interior design. So I sort of was doing night classes, learning how to draft, but like mechanical engineering, drafting, drawing machine parts, because that's the only course I could find.
Right, of course.
It still taught me a skill enough to be able to draw. And that was still hand drawing back then.
Yeah.
Now it's all computer, but I still hand draw a bit. Like when I start a set, it's just my process. I have to hand draw.
Well, there's also something, I mean, I, when you speak to animators and they talk about that shift for them when they had to go from pencil to computer, I don't know how you switch that in your brain because pencil is connected to you. It's a piece of you as you're going. And I think it's got to be such a, as you say, I mean, I think that's why it takes classes and things like that to sort of learn how to not do things in the way you're used to. But no, I don't think anything.
Yeah.
Having seen the books that Guillermo creates, having seen his journals, can you imagine if he didn't draw?
And that's the other thing working with Guillermo that he does draw.
Yeah.
When we meet, we're drawing together. It's not like some directors can't even read a plan, whereas Guillermo can read a plan right, left, and center and understands a detail of a technical drawing and understands a render and gets the height. And he'll say, make that 30% smaller. And he's just get size, shape, all of that.
It's that's why he's special.
So lucky me,
Knowing Guillermo for as long as we've known Guillermo, the thing that I appreciate the most is that he hasn't changed. And as I say, the way that he respects the work that you do, it means so much to have, or I should say, I would think that it means so much to have a director that looks at you and respects your skills, and knows that he needs you to help bring everything to life.
Awesome. Yes, he is. He's also very important to the process
too. Yeah. Yes, of course. But I mean, but that's why you surround yourself with great people. That really is. That's why you do it.
He really is good about keeping a tight team and communicating with everybody.
Yeah.
He's really the master of that, for sure.
And the way he curses doesn't hurt because I love hearing him yell expletives. I should say not at people, but just in life. He loves cursing.
And he loves when you curse a little bit too. So
yes.
I feel like You know, sometimes I can curse with him.
That's when the Canadian comes out and curses, you know things are getting crazy. Thank you so much for your time, Tamara, and congratulations on the nomination.
All right, rounding out this episode, we're going to be speaking to Anastas Michos, who is the director of photography. His nomination is Outstanding Cinematography for a Limited or Anthology Series or Movie. He goes by Tas because he's cool like that. Mm-hmm. And we were speaking to him on his boat. He was on a boat relaxing. This is his break time. We've had a wild set of interviews here. Another one so fascinating. He's worked with all kinds of people. Enjoy.
Where are you on a boat?
I keep her down in the Chesapeake Bay. Hang on, I gotta hit, got it over here. And then sure. It all happens. Yeah. you can hear me all right?
Yes.
Yeah, I live up in the city in New York City, but I keep my boat down in the Chesapeake.
That's lovely.
Oh, lovely.
It is lovely on the Eastern Shore. It's all very bucolic and farmland and rivers and bays and ospreys and blue heron and things.
I feel like you might be a poet. I'm getting the slight sense.
Well, you know, we take advantage of our situations whenever we can. So, you know, with this downtime, it's good to be not in a dark stage. So trying to make up this kind of thing.
That's very true.
Yes, that's true.
Where are you guys?
We are in fabulous Sherman Oaks, California.
We're in exotic Sherman Oaks.
Sherman. I love exotic Sherman Oaks.
Yeah.
That's good.
We're here. It'll do. It's all right.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Are you doing an intro or not?
No, because we're going to put them all together. Okay. All the cabinet of curiosities are going together.
Anastas, yes. Am I calling you Tas?
Yes, my name is Anastas. My last name is Mikos Anastas. My mother named me. But I go by the name of Tas, T-A-S, to those who I've met.
There you go. And what does Guillermo call you? Because I have a feeling it sounds even better in his accent.
And Guillermo doesn't call me anything.
He just points.
If he ever did call me, he just points in the general direction. No, actually, interesting enough, David Pryor was my director.
Yeah.
And Guillermo was the showrunner along with Miles.
Yeah.
And he did not have much to do with any of us on set. He left us to our own devices.
Yeah. Well, he's a smart man and he chooses to work with really talented people, so they tend to be all right.
He wisely delegates.
Yes.
we all do that actually, but there you go. That's the nature of the film business and collaboration.
How did you find cinematography? How did that become your passion and your career?
Oh gosh, that's a long story. I was a student in university studying naval architecture. Thought that's what I kind of wanted to do. I come from a family of musicians, and I kind of bummed around playing music, and then got into theater work. So I never quite graduated university, but then started doing lighting for theater. And I had a next door neighbor who was a documentarian who had collaborated with a director by the name of Robert Muggy, who is a musicologist. Do you know Robert's work? Robert Muggy?
No, his work, yes.
Oh, wow. Well, so way back when I worked on things like Sun Ra and, you know, and Gil Scott-Heron and all those films way back when. And that's when the bug bit me. Mm. And so from there, I got into shooting news. And from there, I met Garrett Brown.
Creator of the Steadicam.
The inventor of the Steadicam and the inventor of something called the Skycam, which is what I collaborated with him on, became a Steadicam operator and tight friends with Garrett, who became my mentor. And then started doing bunches of music videos and somehow acquired a reel, and then jumped into feature work as a camera operator. And I worked for about 10 years, 10, 12 years on various Hollywood films operating before I moved up.
What was this? And I'm going to ask you a sort of a knee-jerk question, a question that requires a a gut answer. What's the most memorable day you've shot on a music video?
Miles Davis's last performance in New Orleans.
That would do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many of them, but that's one that stands out as being somewhat iconic.
Yeah. That my dad is my dad's a jazz nut, and
oh, okay.
One of my of the things I'm jealous of, he got to see so many of the greats perform live. He and my mom got to see a lot of them perform live. And I can't imagine being in your shoes filming him.
Oh, it was phenomenal. And in fact, most interesting, there was a film called Miles, which Don Cheadle directed. And I didn't shoot it. Roberto Schaefer shot it. But they needed a ending sequence. It's about 8-10 years ago, I guess, now. And Bob couldn't do it. Roberto couldn't do it. So I came on board and got to shoot Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, Esmeralda Spalding. I mean, it was just like name after name. And I actually met Herbie because way back when Watermelon Man was on my answer machine. That's such a favorite of mine. So when I got to meet him after the show, the DP, blah, 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 I had to tell him the story about like, I mean, you know, we both cracked up because it was, yeah, that was a fond memory. But yes, I'm a big jazz fan too.
That's amazing. Wow. That's amazing.
Now, do you remember your first day on a conventional set, like for a Hollywood type movie? And was it intimidating?
As a DP?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, as a camera operator.
Yes, it was intimidating. I mean, it had an auspicious start where they asked me to take over to shoot as a DP. Mm. So right then, because of a whole story that needs not to be told. So my first day as an operator was actually my first day as a DP.
Oh,
and
wow.
I wasn't a focus puller on feature films at all. I literally came on board as an operator onto the feature world. And yes, my hands were shaking. trying to line up a day exterior shot. So it was a film called Dream a Little Dream with Jason Robards that I think Mark Irwin shot, or King Daggett or somebody. I can't remember who was the actual DP. But yes, and then my first day as a DP, so I got to shoot Man on the Moon. I was on a camera operator. I had only one little tiny, tiny feature, very tiny.
I love that movie.
It's quite a film, and Milos was, you know, a consummate filmmaker and just amazing to collaborate and work with. And I was working. I had done People versus Larry Flint as an operator with Philippe Rousselot as the DP, and we had collaborated on 7 films, Philippe and I. And the way Man on the Moon came about, interesting enough, is we were coming out of dailies on a film that we were working together in Florida. And I said, hey, Philippe, are you going to do Milos's next movie? And he goes, no, I have to go back to France to do something. And I looked at him as we were getting into our respective cars to go to dinner. I looked at him and said, hey, tell him I'll shoot it. And he shot me this look, and we disappeared into the car. And we met up for dinner, and that's the last I've heard of it. Up to the last day of shooting, I'm up on a crane, my phone rings, it's raining, we're making rain. I'm being yelled at by the first AD because, you know, I'm trying to fix something as an operator on the crane, and why aren't we moving? And it happens to be Michael Houseman, who I knew, saying, when you get back to New York, let's go meet Milos. And I said, okay, because I'd worked with him as an operator before. So to cut to the short of the long story, I wander into Milos's apartment, and I saw him, and hey, Milos, how are you? Hugs. And he was like my big, you know, uncle type of guy. And we talked about the script. I said, are you shooting it anamorphic? He said, you tell me, you're the cameraman. And I went, did he just say cameraman? And I said, did you just say camera? He goes, yes, you're shooting my movie. And that's how I got that gig as a DP.
Just for anyone who isn't clued into this is Milos Forman that we're discussing.
Yes.
Wonderful. Wonderful
film. Wheeler Foreman. Oh my gosh, yes. Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, it goes on.
Yeah.
And Fireman's
yeah.
Ball.
It's an intimidating list. Yeah.
It certainly is.
You worked on another movie I love, Keeping the Faith.
Yes, with Edward.
It's a small movie that a lot of people, I don't think enough people have seen it, but it's such a good movie. And Edward Norton, it's his baby. And I thought he did a really beautiful job with it.
He did. Stuart Blumberg had written the script with Edward, I think.
Yeah.
And I'd met Edward on Larry Flint.
Right.
And then I worked with him on something else. I can't remember. And then he asked me to shoot his film with him. And of course, Milos is in that film.
Yeah.
Milos Forman is actually plays the priest.
Yeah.
He plays Edward's mentor. And we shot that in New York, and we wanted it to be very much a postcard and a love story to New York. And it's a very light touch about what is faith and what is friendship and what is love, and some very deep themes in a very lighthearted and funny movie.
Mm-hmm.
People who see your list of credits, including camera operator and assistant director of photography and director of photography and all that, might think that you are a technician. But we've been spreading the gospel as long as we've been doing this. You're all storytellers. That's what you do.
Yes. I mean, what drew me to the art form is visual storytelling.
Mm.
If you don't have a sense of story and you don't have a narrative, then all you're doing is taking 24 frames a second of pictures, which have no basis in the emotional core of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, the role of the cinematographer is to give an audience a visual, emotional reaction, to elicit that from them. Just the way music does, just the way dialogue does, and just the way characters do. So without that sense or a knowledge of what story structure is, it's very difficult to shoot a feature film or television series or anything that has a narrative arc.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, commercials and whatnot is a different genre. Music videos are different as well, because they don't necessarily have narrative arcs.
Right.
But when you work in a form that does so, the juxtaposition of those images have to mean something, and how you plunge somebody into darkness or brightness or color or whatever you're doing, you know, whatever you're choosing to show the art world.
It's really wild to look through your credits because they're so varied. No,
yeah.
You know,
don't tell me. My agent says that all the time.
But it's true. Look, you've got a Pink Floyd TV special. You've got Rocky V. You've got Billy Joel live at Yankee Stadium, which I cannot begin to imagine what that was like.
Eddie Murphy, Raw. All these early credits of yours.
The Doors, and then something like Toy Soldiers and Home Alone 2. It's so, and then What's Eating Gilbert Grape. And even up to now, even up to now, working on something like The Purge and The Kissing Booth, and then Guillermo's Cabinet of Curiosities. And I'm laughing because it's so wild and fun.
But partly is, I mean, the earlier stuff that you brought up is as a camera operator. Some of those were DPs. I shot a bunch of music videos as a DP. But ultimately what happens is, particularly with long form, it is impossible for us storytellers not to be affected by the story.
Mm-hmm.
And when you live anything from 5 weeks to 50 weeks of day in and day out trying to craft that story, particularly the dark ones, you do carry the burden of some of the despair of human existence with you. I mean, not to the degree an actor does, but remember, we're in that 12 hours a day. Right. You know, we're listening to actors 12 hours a day. In fact, we're trying to bolster them up. We're trying to make it darker still. We're trying to get to the core of what their arc is and elevate it to some degree with what we do. So by that very nature, you know, coming off of a dark film or a very dramatic film or a film that deals with really the human condition, and sometimes not it's in its best light, it's just really wonderful to go to a wonderful love story. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason The Kissing Booth came along is because I was doing this thing with David Pryor called The Empty Man. And The Empty Man is a very dark film about existentialism, which is interesting enough why David even took Cabinet of Curiosities, because it's exploring the same themes about what does it mean to be alive and what is life. And so we were in Cape Town doing this crazy horror suspense thriller about, you know, this other world. And a producer that I knew, Michelle Weisler, was in town, and I had dinner, and she was kept on talking about her sweet little rom-com. And she said the word sweet about five times, and I kept on going, do you have a DP? Because I could do sweet right about now. You know, sweet sounds really good. And that's how I got involved with Vince Marcello and the Kissing Booth series, because I jumped off of this very, very dark thing into this, you know, this very romantic, sweet, hopeful love story.
You needed an antidote.
Yes, I did. When I came off of, I had done Interview with a Vampire and Mary Riley back to back.
Wow.
And David Fincher and Darius Kanji asked me to do Seven. I mean, they literally got on the phone with me together and said, would you do this movie with us? And I had to turn it down. Mm. I mean, because I had read the script and Gwyneth Paltrow's head was in a box.
Right.
And I just couldn't, you know. I mean, because, you know, I mean, having worked with Interview with a Vampire was a dark film.
Yes.
And Mary Riley was a very dark film. Mr. Hyde story. So, yes, that does affect me, and it does, I think, affects most filmmakers.
Yeah. Well, again, if this is your everyday, if this is day in, day out what you're living, and, you know, filming schedules in general can be very hard, you know, regardless of size, they can be hard anyway. But then if you're dealing with stories that require a lot, it is, as you say, it's nice. Sometimes it's nice to go, oh, it's just about young kids in love. Great. Let's go do that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Will there be sunshine and hugs?
Will there be sunshine and hugs and little hearts on the screen with emojis? Yeah. Yes, there will be. Lots of emojis on the screen. Let's go do it.
Let's go.
So that's how I kind of, that's why my resume is possibly as varied as it is. You know, I never like to be pigeonholed. Nor do I ever like to have a specific style.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You adapt to the material.
Yes, as I think any good artist has to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you were asked to write a jazz piece, you don't write it symphonically.
Right.
You know, you decide that this jazz piece is going to be a folk ballad. No, and I'm going to play it on the banjo. No, you're going to write the jazz piece.
Right.
So that's what we do, you know.
What do you enjoy about the technological advances, and what do you miss?
I miss dailies.
Mm.
Ah.
You know, the structure of film is what I miss.
Sure.
Film had structure in it because it was a precious commodity.
Right.
So that meant that there was a attention to detail from the time the AD said rolling to cut. That we don't tend to find in the digital world. That's one, because everybody has to be incredibly focused, because it's going through at, you know, 1,000 feet a mag, and you can just see the money just being spent. And the other part I missed because of that is dailies, which was the collective coming together to critique the work. And that's what dailies really is. It's the collective, all of us, from props to costumes to focus pullers to camera operators, DP. I mean, normally it'll be a DP, director, and an editor sitting together, or with a production designer somewhere next to them. And in that room is also the heads of department. And we're all looking at what we collectively created. And we also, and it's not necessarily a safe place because our jobs are on the line, but it is a place where when we do feel safe, you know, week three, that we can critique what we're doing and make the process better or make what we're doing better, the story better. So I lament that. I lament the word film being taken over by the word content.
That comes up for us a lot. Yeah, that's.
I lament the word photograph versus capture. Capture implies that somehow or other it's not changed and somehow it's not created. So language, I lament the language of what we used to do, because I believe that language defines task often, you know, and language defines our existence. And so when we start changing our language, we start changing what we do. But I could go blah, blah, blah about that for a long time.
Well, no, we spoke to Sam Pollard a few weeks ago, and, you know, he's one of the greatest editors. And we talked about the difference of going from a moviola and real film to, you know, everything being digital. And he said the difference, exactly like you're saying, is that you had to be really precious. You had to know what you wanted to get on that film because you only had so much and it was expensive, you know, but also when you were going to make a cut, you were making a physical cut. So when you wanted to make that edit and you made that edit, if you needed to change that, you had to go back and start all over again.
Absolutely. So the latency of the image also makes the creative process percolate more. You know, there is that process that as the DP, I was the only one who had I was the one that had the strongest sense of what it was going to look like. And even then, I'm pushing my own limits and boundaries. And it's the same thing in editorial when you can only try one cut at a time. And if you decide you're going to keep on trimming frames, well, pretty much you're going to end up with a whole bunch of like tape. Just trying to put like, you know, 15 frames together held by tape. So that way you thought about it a little bit more before you just took the knife to it. So there is a difference, you know, and there's also the sense of, and the sense of technology that cameras and film are by their very nature, film by its very nature is organic. It's a moving image even when still. Even when a still frame is projected, the grain is moving, the projector is breathing a little bit. We are knowingly entering another reality besides our own.
Yeah.
Digital by its very nature is not that. A digital still frame is literally still. There's nothing moving about it. To the fact that we keep on adding grain back in post to give it some sort of what we call life. It is irony. Absolutely is, you know. Those are the beats that I would hit, you know, in answer to your question.
Just to round things off, what does recognition, like an Emmy nomination, mean to you?
It gives validity to the phrase, it's great to be nominated. I never thought what we did as a contest and the best of anything, it is meaningless. It really is. Because all of us are working different genres with different styles. And to compare one thing better than another thing is impossible. The best cinematography, Academy Award for best. And you go, oh, the best. It's just that one's just different than the other one.
Yeah.
But the nomination process comes from my peers. So as with the ASC nomination and the Emmy nomination, it is your peers that recognize the work and they give you a nod. So getting the attaboy from my peers is nice. There's no question about it.
Yeah. And this series, we know in getting to speak to different folks who worked on Cabinet, and they really are, you all are, you're the best at what you do. To speak to the prosthetics guys, to speak to the production design, to speak to all these different folks bringing it together, and then there you are capturing it. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I was, it's a collective art form.
Yeah.
Many times I'm told that I don't hold the accolade enough to my own process, but I firmly believe my process is in there. But my ideas can only come through fruition because I work with a director, you know, and they are chosen by that director. He's the arbitrator of that taste, or she is the arbitrator of those. And like I always say, if you don't like this one, I have another one. So let me just keep on throwing them at you. Well, because ideas have no ownership. Mm-hmm. Once they're spoken, they're just out there in the ether, mm-hmm. you know? And if you don't want to use it, I'll just put it right back into the idea factory in the back of my head, and it'll spin out again in some other form. And the other thing is that I was very fortunate to be surrounded by a group and a crew that were top-notch professionals.
Yes.
And it's a two-way street. I never threw out anything I knew that could not be accomplished. But when you have an accomplished crew, you can therefore then throw out grander and grander ideas to be able to be, you know, executed in the time we have on television, which is, you know, limited. I mean, it's 58 minutes. I think we shot in 14 days. I think we did 14, 15 days. I don't remember what that, I mean,
that's nuts.
So it, at times it's nutty, but you surround yourself with the best, and Miles, certainly with Guillermo's crew in Toronto, was the creme de la creme of filmmakers in the Western hemisphere, those guys, everybody. Oh, and Tamara did an amazing job, because her work is spectacular, because she had literally eight separate dissimilar sets to build. She was doing eight movies at one time.
Yes.
With no crossover sets. Nothing. I mean, nobody else had a coal mine.
Yeah.
You know? So.
I love that you both worked on Death to Smoochie.
We did, and that's one of my favorite films. Yes, we did talk about it. Danny brought us together, and that's where I did that up in Toronto as well.
Yeah,
that's an unsung film, actually.
I agree.
It's very dark but very funny, and I have to tell you, Robin Williams with, oh my gosh, Edward Norton, John Stewart, and Danny and Catherine Keener. I mean, just going back to the hotel after work and sitting at the bar was a treat.
I can't.
And yeah.
I got to talk to Tamara yesterday.
Oh, okay, and, great.
Yeah. And she's so talented, and like so many, so sort of, you're telling her how brilliant she is and everything she's done. And she's sort of going, yeah, well, you know, she's terribly Canadian. And doesn't see herself, but I mean, that's part of what makes her a nice person is she doesn't think she's the queen of everything, but so much talent. And as I say, the fact that you both worked on that movie, which definitely is one that didn't get enough attention. And I love when people find it because it's so strange, but you know,
yeah. I mean, you take Danny's sensibilities and sense of humor and you mix them with Robin Williams and, you know, and off to the races we went.
Yeah. Stand back.
Stand back is true. Stand back is true.
That's wild. Well, congratulations. And
well, thank you so
for
much.
Your time.
Thank you for taking out the time to talk to us, Seth.
And it was lovely chatting with you guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. You take care.
Right.
Well, that was fun.
That was so much fun. I mean, again, someone like Guillermo is just an inspiring guy. And I can't imagine him working with anyone who wasn't at that level.
No, who doesn't have that fire inside.
They really do. As I say, Tamara, who I was speaking to in the car, she was leaving the next day to go to Scotland to scout with Guillermo for the next project. they never stop. And we're lucky because we get so much, we get so many interesting and unique stories from these folks.
Yeah.
Man, oh man. Thank you guys as always for listening. You can find That Guy Leonard Maltin and me on Instagram and Twitter. He's also on Facebook. You can go to YouTube where we have a channel called Maltin on Movies. You can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff. And of course, the Maltreon Patreon.
Patreon.
And we're so, so, so grateful to everyone who helps support us there.
We appreciate every donation, and we have different ways of thanking you.
Yep. That's us thanking you. Have a good week. We'll talk to you later.
Take care.